This is where we live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Hydro-Québec is the fourth largest hydropower company in the world. It produces the cheapest low-carbon electricity in North America. But how it got here involves a history of encroaching on some of Quebec's Indigenous people. Later, we'll talk with a reporter and host at New Hampshire Public Radio about that complicated history. That's later. Now, how much do you know about the U.S.'s relationship with Canada? Strategically, it makes sense to be friendly with a border country, but what factors led to the ties both countries have maintained for years? Coming up, a political scientist with a focus on international relations and Canadian politics will join us to answer our questions and yours. But first, what has led to this trade dispute between the U.S. and Canada? And how will it impact us here in New England? You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Email wherewelive at WMPR.org. And as always, find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. I want to welcome to the show Daniel Dale. He's Washington correspondent for the Toronto Star. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
We're going to be learning a little bit more about how and why the U.S. and Canada have been typically close allies. But we wanted to focus in on news in recent weeks about this trade dispute with its closest allies, the U.S.'s trade dispute with Canada, Mexico, and also the EU. Let's talk about how Canada is responding to this increase in tariffs from the Trump administration.
So Canada has announced that it will impose retaliatory tariffs on what it says is an equivalent amount of U.S. products. This is in response to Trump's tariffs on Canadian steel and aluminum. Canada says that those tariffs will come into effect on July 1st, Canada Day, coincidentally or not, which is this weekend. And Canada plans to hit not only U.S. steel and aluminum, but also a variety of other U.S. products, from playing cards to whiskey to orange juice. And they say that this retaliation list is targeted at swing states that matter politically, and also particularly important Republican lawmakers. So Canada is trying to put pressure on the Trump administration and the Republican-controlled Congress by retaliating against the products that are important in their districts.
Now, what is the White House's goals in imposing these tariffs in the first place against Canada?
Well, they say that they want to revive the struggling U.S. steel and aluminum industry. And their argument is that, you know, by making it harder for foreign countries to import their own steel and aluminum, to export their own steel and aluminum to the U.S. industry will have some sort of breathing space to reinvigorate itself, you know, to fire up those plants that have been shuttered over the past 35 years and do better than it's been doing.
Mm-hmm. Now, in March, I believe President Trump had said that Canada would be exempt from these tariffs. But what changed between March and today, Daniel?
Well, he never really seems to want to exempt Canada, but he was lobbied to do it by people in his own administration and senior Republicans in Congress. He gave Canada that first exemption, then a second exemption. But he always said, you know, if we don't make progress on NAFTA, then we're going to take that exemption off. Some people were skeptical that he actually would remove the exemption, but he ended up doing so.
We know that the dispute has escalated to the point of personal insults. We have a clip. This is President Trump's economic advisor, Peter Navarro, saying this about Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau after the G7 summit earlier this month in Quebec.
There's a special place in hell for any foreign leader that engages in bad faith diplomacy with President Donald J. Trump and then tries to stab him in the back on the way out the door. And that's what bad faith Justin Trudeau did with that stunt press conference. That's what weak, dishonest Justin Trudeau did.
So, Daniel, what is the response from Canadians to this idea that's bad faith Justin Trudeau, these insults that are coming not only from some of the administration level members of President Trump, but even President Trump himself? They were upset from what Prime Minister Trudeau had said right after the G7 summit. Tell us exactly what he said.
Well, it's confusing to Canadian officials and to a lot of others because at that post G7 press conference, Trudeau just said the same things that he'd been saying about Trump's tariffs for a week. He said that it's an insult, an affront to Canada, given that the tariffs are officially being imposed on national security grounds, And given that Canada has fought with the U.S., you know, for decades, and Canadian soldiers have died with American soldiers, you know, in the First and Second World War. And so Trudeau just, you know, in a very measured diplomatic tone, said those same things. Trump, for whatever reason, got angry about it this time and apparently dispatched Navarro and economic advisor Larry Kudlow to the Sunday shows to lob personal insults at Trudeau. And so the on-the-record Canadian response is that Canada does not engage in such ad hominem attacks in its international relations and doesn't believe that such attacks are a productive way to conduct diplomacy.
Daniel Dell's on the phone with us. He's Washington Bureau Chief for the Toronto Star. As we look into this trade dispute between the U.S. and Canada. Now, Daniel, U.S. and Canada have been close allies for years, but let's talk about the trading partnership and why this is a big deal if these tariffs, these retaliatory tariffs are sent our way and what President Trump has recommended as well.
Yeah, I mean, this is a massive trading relationship. The numbers have slipped my mind, but it's billions of dollars every week, obviously, and the U.S. market is central to Canadian companies. Obviously, it's our biggest export market, and the particular businesses that are being hit are also important. You know, there's about $5 billion of steel trade each way per year, for example. Canada sends much more aluminum to the U.S. than the U.S. sends to Canada. We're talking about billions of dollars there as well. So these are big businesses. We don't know what the macroeconomic impact of the tariffs will be. Some economists say that the impact might be quite small. You know, you might notice price increases if you're a consumer on particular consumer products, on grocery items, for example, but that the broader economy won't feel it that much. But the danger, I think, is, you know, if this continues escalating, we continue doing a tit-for-tat series of responses, then, you know, after a while, there might be at least a slight impact on the economy as a whole.
I understand that the U.S. is Canada's biggest trading partner, and Canada is our second largest trading partner after China, so there's a lot at stake here.
There absolutely is, yeah. I mean, the NAFTA is hugely important to companies on both sides of the border, and so when we're talking about tariffs or we're talking about renegotiating this 24-year-old trade agreement, we're talking about, you know, issues that really matter to, you know, to literally millions of people on both sides of the border.
There's something that you said earlier that I wanted to maybe drill down a little bit more, and how the Trump administration is justifying these tariffs based on national security. Can you explain that rationale to us?
Well, they're using a 1964 trade law that defines national security very broadly. And so it basically says that the economic health of an industry can be important to national security. So they're not explicitly saying, you know, Canada is a national security threat to us. They're saying having a bad, weak steel industry in the United States is a national security threat to the United States. Canada still, though, takes offense because, you know, the Canadian argument is, you know, even if you do have a weak domestic steel industry, we are not going to desert you in some sort of hypothetical crisis. We're still going to continue providing you the steel you need. And so, you know, the U.S. administration is relying on this loose, broad interpretation, but Canada still takes offense.
You can join our conversation on Where We Live, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, at Where We Live. Again, Daniel Dale from the Toronto Star on the phone with us. And I want to welcome into our discussion now Jeff Ayers. He's with us from NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C. Jeff is professor of political science at St. Michael's College in Vermont. He focuses on international relations and Canadian politics. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So how unprecedented is this trade fight between our country and Canada?
Well, I think it's, as your first host has been discussing, it's somewhat unprecedented in terms of the level of personal attacks and the way in which social norms have been undermined. There certainly is a long history of extraordinarily good relations between the two countries, but there have been some incidents in the past history involving trade that we could talk a little bit about, where there's been disagreements between the two countries, and there's certainly been concern over the decades, well up into the latter part of the 20th century, on the part of Canadians as to whether they should go all in and have a free trade agreement with the United States. So I would say it's the most stable and mutually beneficial relationship in the world, but there's certainly a history of occasional spats between the two countries.
Tell us about some of those spats.
Well, one for example would be back in the 1930s. I think 1930, when the Smoot-Hawley tariff was passed by Congress, and as we were moving into the Depression, I mean, there's some observers right now are concerned that the United States, as we're increasingly acting in a very mercantilist way by slapping tariffs on various countries around the world, that we could be setting ourselves up for a significant trade dispute and a dramatic decline in trade. I think that Canada-U.S. trade fell by over 75% after the Smoot-Hawley tariff was instituted in 1930. There was also something known as the Nixon shock under President Nixon back in the early 1970s. I think it was 1971 that the Nixon administration applied a 10% tariff on goods coming into the United States. And it shocked Canadians, this deep, long-lasting historical and cultural relationship, as well as ultimately, especially post-World War II, political and economic relationship. It was very shocking. And then, in fact, Nixon and Pierre Trudeau, the current prime minister's father, did not have a good relationship. And I think within a year or so, Nixon declared the special relationship between Canada and the United States dead. It's interesting. Sometimes it has a little personal side to it. The last incident I might mention is a really significant debate in Canada in the 1980s, culminating in the Canada-U.S. Free Trade Agreement that was signed in 1988, came into being in 1989. That was a really big deal. Lots of debate, lots of soul-searching and questioning as to whether Canadians should sign a free trade agreement that I think ultimately has been extraordinarily beneficial for Canada as well as the United States.
Now, Jeff, you're based in Vermont, very close to the border with Quebec. What does this mean for Vermont and other states in the U.S. that also are exporting to Canada?
Yeah, it's a really what we mean is, if this all continues to go through, if Canada in fact does retaliate with tariffs against American U.S. goods as of July 1st, and then should the Trump administration follow up, one of the even perhaps greater concerns is that the Trump administration is threatening to put 25% tariffs on auto exports from Canada, which would have a huge impact. So it's countrywide. Obviously, New England, it would hit New England significantly. There's over 35 states right now across the country that Canada is the largest export market for. Interestingly enough, it's not in Connecticut. I think France is Connecticut's largest export market, but the other New England states and the vast majority of other U.S. states have Canada as their largest export market. And so this growing trade dispute could certainly impact consumers. I mean, on both sides of the border, but on our side, we would see prices go up on a variety of different goods. So Vermonters obviously are Vermonters are concerned about the same sort of things that people across New England are. But we are certainly proud of our maple syrup industry, and that's actually something that's on the list of products that could be targeted by Canada. But I think consumers would feel it. Businesses would certainly feel it. Businesses there's a lot of uncertainty right now. One of the issues that just doesn't seem to be understood all that well by the administration or talked about is just how deeply integrated all these different sectors already are, from the auto industry, the steel industry, the dairy industry. There's such deep integration between the two countries that gearing up for this type of a trade dispute between the two countries just doesn't make economic sense or political sense.
This is Where We Live. We're looking into what's caused this trade dispute between U.S. and Canada. Again, longtime allies. You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Jim's been holding from Darien. Jim, go ahead.
Good morning. How are you?
We're doing well. What's your question or comment?
Well, I think this is all just bluster on the part of the Trump administration. You know, part of his approach toward nationalism. I've lived in the United States for almost 55 years now, and naturalized after living here 15 years. But I kept my Canadian citizenship. I'm proud to be a Canadian. I fly the maple leaf. What I used to know as Dominion Day, Canada Day is coming up July 1st. And there are a lot of Canadians down here. We pass pretty well. People don't know we're not Americans. But we're very proud of our heritage, and I think anybody that in the States thinks that Canada is a state is grossly mistaken. So I think this will all work itself out, but I think the Trump administration is just posturing at this point.
Well, thank you, Jim, for your comments. I wanted to get our guest to respond. Daniel Dale, what did you think about what Jim was saying there?
Well, I think respectfully that it's past the point of bluster. I think at first, you know, Canadian officials thought the same. I think it's a reasonable thought. But now we're talking about real tariffs on real people. You know, the steel and aluminum tariffs are in place. There's a serious threat of auto tariffs. I guess those could be bluster. But in addition to all that, you know, we have the Trump administration taking a very hard line in NAFTA negotiations, and we don't know how those will work out. And so I think, you know, the moment that it passed the point of bluster was when those exemptions were removed and steel and aluminum tariffs were indeed applied to Canadian businesses.
Daniel, if you could talk a little bit more about the impact on auto manufacturers in this U.S. because of the tariffs on Canada, the steel tariffs.
Well, I mean, the auto industry is a major user of steel, but I haven't seen any hard reporting on how this very integrated industry might be impacted. And so I wouldn't feel comfortable talking specifically about that sector.
Jeff, can you talk a little bit more about integration?
Well, I think first relating to the caller, I think on the one hand, this does fit the broader posturing of the Trump administration. This is kind of this might even be the art of the deal. I mean, there's this approach to diplomacy and international relations that the Trump administration takes that ends up being very insulting as this zero-sum, you know, transactional approach that is undermining norms internationally as well as, I said, social norms. So I think on the one hand, this is kind of a negotiating, blustering tactic. But I also agree with Daniel that it's gone beyond that now. And we actually have a lot of evidence beyond just our relationship with Canada of the United States increasingly pulling back from collaborating internationally. The integration piece, again, I also agree, we don't know yet what the impact would be, except that it would be tremendous in terms of if the Trump administration were to put a significant tariff on autos coming into the United States. I mean, it is you all appropriately went over the depth of the relationship. It's the second largest bilateral trade relationship in the world. It's over $670 billion in U.S. goods and services last year. Canada is the largest market for U.S. agricultural imports, which is ironic because that we've had, you know, part of what's going on as well is I agree with Daniel that Canadians, and I agree with Canadians being confused because and uncertain as to what the United States position is, because on the one hand, I think the Trump administration started out threatening these tariffs, to apply these tariffs in part because it was dissatisfied with the pace of the NAFTA negotiations. Then it shifted to linking these tariffs on national security grounds. And then even most recently, the Trump administration was blaming Canada's protection of its dairy industry. And ironically, the United States has a surplus in terms of dairy with Canada. So there's a lot of confusion and misinformation out there.
Now, Jeff Ayers, I wanted to ask you as well, we know what the federal government stance is to this point, but what about if we're looking at New England and partnerships between, governors here in New England and with leaders in Canada? Is there a role to play there and how this situation could maybe not be as difficult come July 1st if these tariffs do come down the line from Canada?
Absolutely. There's a huge role, and that's one of the really important foundations of the Canada-U.S. relationship is what goes on at the sub-federal level, or multiple different ways in which states and provinces and citizens, of course, of both states, both countries are integrated. So one of the key organizations, for example, is the New England Governors and Canadian Eastern Premiers group or association. It's made up of 11 states and provinces, including Quebec, all of the New England states and the Maritimes, and they meet annually. I think it's a really important example of what we call paradiplomacy or sub-federal international relations, where groups are that particularly, for instance, in this relationship, those members of that association are really working on a daily basis to develop networks, to deepen the relationship, to really share ideas and advance common interests. And They have their upcoming annual conference, I think, is in Stowe, Vermont, this August. And give you an example of how different their interactions are with what we're hearing at the national level right now. Last year, in 2017, the premiers and governors passed several resolutions that were supportive of trade integration and touted the benefits of cross-border trade. There was a resolution passed focusing on the importance of acting collaboratively against climate change and how the region would respond in emergencies during climate change. So I think not only is this actually a really important example of the kind of collaboration that's ongoing, I think it's even more crucial right now to demonstrate that we can, you know, beyond the bluster or even potentially the really damaging acts at the national level, there's a lot of goodwill and cooperation going on at the sub-federal level.
Daniel Dale is also with us again, Washington Bureau Chief for the Toronto Star. Daniel, you've been doing some unscientific polling since the dispute has come into the news headlines, you know, what Americans are thinking about this as well as Canadians. What can you tell us about it?
Well, Canadians are very unhappy. We've seen scientific polling in the last week that shows that Trump's approval rating among Canadians has fallen to 11%. There's 74% support for Trudeau's retaliatory tariffs, according to this poll. And this crosses party lines. You know, there's slightly stronger support among Trudeau's liberal voters, of course, but even conservative voters, the opposition voters, are strongly behind the prime minister on this one. And there is, I think, as the prime minister has said, a sense of personal offense that Canada, of all countries, is being targeted here. As far as Americans' views, you know, it's not exactly clear. We haven't had polling about the tariffs on Canada in particular, but I spent a day in a Walmart in North Carolina, and I asked people entering and exiting how they felt about both the tariffs and the Trump administration's personal insults of Prime Minister Trudeau. And it basically broke down along partisan lines. You know, I was curious because Canada has long enjoyed overwhelmingly bipartisan approval in the U.S. It is not a bipartisan issue. One poll in 2016 showed Canada had 75% approval, 3% disapproval. So this is, you know, this crosses all party lines. But what I found in North Carolina, at least in this one location, was that Republicans thought that Canada had been taking advantage of the United States, as Trump said. They thought that Trudeau was wrong. Some of them cited the milk tariffs. And so it was fascinating how quickly Trump's talking points had changed the views of at least some of his voters. While, you know, Democratic voters I encountered were aghast at this. You know, they said Canada, close ally. Why would you hurt them? They were offended that, you know, the Trump administration was insulting Trudeau personally. And so, yeah, I think the fear for Canadian diplomats is that Trump makes Canada just another partisan issue rather than the subject of a universal American consensus.
Now, Daniel, before we let you go, you just mentioned when you were polling some North Carolinians, I think at a Walmart, they mentioned the milk tariff. And this is something that President Trump has complained, the dairy supply management system in Canada. Can you break that down for us in 2 minutes?
Yes, I'll try. It's a complicated subject. Basically, Canada does indeed have a strict protectionist system for dairy and poultry. Trump is focused on dairy, and it's a system of a bunch of policies, but the policies that matter to foreign producers, American producers, are tight quotas on imports, so it's hard for foreigners to get much access to the Canadian market. And then, in addition to those quotas, any imports over top of the quota amount are subjected to very high tariffs. You know, more than 200% on things like milk and cream and other dairy products. And so, the system is meant to protect Canadian farmers, Canadian suppliers, and in some ways it has, you know, something in common with what Trump is trying to do in protecting American industries of various kinds. But Canadians themselves have split views on what's called supply management because it results in Canada having much higher dairy prices than there are in the United States and in some other countries. Other Canadians see it as important, you know, to protect domestic agriculture. So, you know, this is politically controversial in Canada as well as with Trump now. But the dairy lobby, dairy farmers are quite powerful politically in Canada. All parties do not want to anger them. And when Trudeau even hinted that he was willing to make some sort of concession to Trump in NAFTA talks over this, the leader of the conservative opposition, Andrew Scheer, said, what do you mean by flexibility? What do you mean by, you know, are you talking about giving up any kind of, any part of supply management? And so even if Trudeau wanted to give in to Trump, you know, there's pressure from the right, from the Conservative Party, to not give in any way. So this is obviously very complicated.
I think you did it in 2 minutes. Good job, Daniel.
Thank you.
Daniel Dale is Washington Bureau Chief for the Toronto Star. Again, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Political scientist Jeff Ayers is going to stay with us as we learn more about the U.S.-Canada relations through the years. Now, are you an American who visits Canada often? Are you a Canadian living here in the U.S.? We want to hear from you, too. 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We've been learning how a current trade dispute between the U.S. and Canada has soured relations in recent weeks, but we also wanted to dive back into history to learn how our relationship with our northern neighbor got to where it is today. From NPR Studios in Washington, D.C., Jeff Ayers is with us, professor of political science at St. Michael's College in Vermont, who focuses on international relations and Canadian politics. Jeff, we heard President Trump also recently take a deep dive into North American history, but he got it a little wrong. And talking about the War of 1812. What was your response to what he said, accusing the Canadians of trying to burn down the White House?
Well, one of my first thoughts was that, you know, Canada didn't exist then. I mean, the Dominion of Canada came into being in 1867, so that was actually the British that were more directly involved in the War of 1812. And so I think, you know, part of my thinking is just a lack of reflects the broader lack of understanding and appreciation of Canada-U.S. relations and Canadian history on the part of Americans here on our side of the border. But I think, you know, I what you just said as you were leading in, I also want to back up and say that I think how we've gotten to this point, yes, we're in a moment of fairly unprecedented verbal assaults and a pretty significant brewing trade dispute, but we also are still at a moment of, as I tried to say earlier on, a remarkably stable and beneficial relationship that involves military cooperation, involves economics, involves, you know, phenomenal cross-border activity. Over 20 million Canadians visited the United States last year. Cultural relationships, you know, so we can, things that I appreciate very much, as you said, I live in the greater Burlington, Vermont area. Yesterday, June 24th, it's called Saint-Jean-de-Baptiste Day. It's Quebec's national holiday, and if you go on Church Street in Burlington on that day, you'll see the fleur-de-lis flying as a kind of welcome to Quebecers who are coming in. So I think, you know, across the border, there's a great deal of goodwill and support for each other that's going on at the sub-federal level, and I think also at the national level. I think there's one of the strategies that Canadians do extremely well is they understand our political process very well, and they know that it's very important to continue to keep good relations and lobby Congress, not just the president. So I think there's a lot good that's still going on, and we can talk a little bit about that.
It's important that you did bring up that point, because it's not just about sharing business and border, but also the culture and being up in Vermont, seeing that relationship between Vermont and Quebec. But after the War of 1812, let's talk a little bit about that stability that has been there since those times.
Mm-hmm. Sure. No, I think so. What really the particular foundations of this, again, very stable and beneficial relationship emerged in the 20th century, and I think around World War II, the relationships between prime ministers and presidents are oftentimes key. And at that time, in the 1940s, I think it was actually 1940 that Prime Minister Mackenzie King developed a very strong relationship with President Franklin Roosevelt, and they signed several different agreements. They established a permanent joint board of defense to collaborate extensively and deeply integrate cooperation together in the face of World War II. Following that, in the 1950s, NORAD was created, the North American Aerospace Defense Command. So the United States and Canada right now, to this day, continue to jointly police, if you will, North American airspace and air sovereignty, and it's a crucial way in which we collaborate in the event of some sort of attack on the northern part of the North American continent, and there's a auto pact from the 1960s, and then again the economically the free trade agreement, which was also formed in part by presidential prime ministerial relations. At the time, the prime minister in Canada was Brian Mulroney of the Progressive Conservatives. He had a majority government in the 80s, and he formed a strong relationship with President Ronald Reagan, and I think that personal relationship helped the two countries come together to sign the Canada-U.S. Free Trade Agreement. It, as I said, it was very controversial in Canada. It was actually somewhat similar. The debate was somewhat similar to the debate over NAFTA that we've had in the United States, concerns about potential job loss. But overall, there's just been a continual building on this foundation politically, economically, culturally, socially, that I think, again, marks this as one of the more remarkable international relationships in the world.
We heard from a caller earlier who is Canadian and now lives in the U.S. talking about, you know, you can't tell the difference between a Canadian and an American. Can we talk more about the similarities between the two countries and the fact that so many people have ties across the border, especially when we look up in Vermont?
Well, there's an incredibly deep shared cultural and historical heritage. Tens of thousands of Francophones, French speakers, left Quebec or the eastern part of Canada to come into New England to work in the mills. I mean, there's been a great deal of cross-border movement. My own family, of my mother's side, was born in Ontario. My youngest daughter was born in Ontario for different. We have. So many Americans and Canadians have family ties that I think connect the two. There's certainly a commonality in language. Certainly outside of Quebec, obviously a very important French piece to Canada. But generally speaking, Canadians and Americans share the same language. They share similar political and economic values. And one of the things that I try to tell Canadians sometimes is that, you know, this is a bit of an exaggeration, but there are more people in Canada with Canadian values than there are Canadians, if that makes any sense. In other words, so it's not this giant monolith of antagonistic anti-Canadians that exist in the United States. There's a great deal of affection. And I do think this is a particularly unusual dispute right now. But also, if you have to put it in the broader picture of what's going on with the United States globally.
There's also, you had mentioned earlier, and I know Daniel had also alluded to this, that there's not a lot of knowledge that Americans have about Canada. And I'm curious if you could talk more about the country's relationship with Great Britain.
Canada's relationship?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Canada obviously, it still has a very strong relationship with Britain. In 1867, the British North America Act, an act of Britain's Parliament, created the Dominion of Canada, and most historians look at that in part. It was a moment where the UK was looking at the United States after the Civil War and was looking at a very powerful Union army, and there were great concerns that were there not a sovereign entity, which is what gradually became Canada north of the border after 1867, we may have, acted on manifest destiny up north. So I think, but gradually Canada has assumed greater and greater independence, if you will, from the UK. I will say something that puzzles Americans, obviously, is if you go to Canada and you look at their currency and you see the Queen on the money, the Queen, Queen Elizabeth II, is still the head of state. So the Crown is the head of state, and the head of government in Canada is the Prime Minister, currently Justin Trudeau. However, having said that, I wouldn't say that the overwhelming majority of Canadians are overt monarchists. It's actually an important difference politically between the two countries to have a separation between a head of state and head of government. We don't have that in the United States, so there remains obviously great historic ties, economic ties between Canada and Britain. But I would certainly make the case that sharing the border that we do and sharing the continental history that we do and sharing the size of this trading relationship, again, being the second largest bilateral trade relationship in the world, I think there has been kind of a shift almost from the Canada-Britain relationship in the post-World War II era. The special relationship shifted to from Canada and Britain more to Canada and the United States.
I wanted to ask what the Canadians' relationship is with the Indigenous people there, also known as the First Nations, and how that's different than what we have reconciled with here in the United States for what was done to the Native Americans here.
That's a great question. I mean, it'll be very interesting to see. Next year is next year is the federal election for Justin Trudeau's Liberals will be gunning for another majority, and certainly one of the major campaign pledges of Trudeau's Liberals and Trudeau himself was to kind of have a rapprochement, to have a new relationship with Canada's Indigenous peoples. Just in terms of the number of First Nations peoples, there's three different groups, if you will. There's Inuit, there's Métis, and there's a First Nations community, and there are simply more Aboriginal peoples in Canada per capita than there are in the United States, vis-a-vis in terms of Canadian population, in terms of our population. So there's, in some ways, a little bit more of a political impact, but there's also a very interesting history in terms of the way in which Indigenous peoples and the relationship between Indigenous peoples and Canadian successive Canadian governments have evolved. And there seems to be a much greater willingness, even though there's a lot to be, much more has to be done, I think, to address socioeconomic concerns facing Indigenous peoples. There's been a willingness on the part of successive Canadian governments, including the one that preceded Justin Trudeau, the conservative Stephen Harper's government, to speak openly about transgressions, to speak openly about the reservation system, to speak openly about the pain and suffering Indigenous peoples experienced in Canada. And that's, I think, in part what Justin Trudeau's campaign a few years ago, he recognized that there seemed to be, in part, it's a more of a political, cultural openness on the part of Canadians to reach some sort of, I'll say it again, a kind of a rapprochement or renew the relationship with First Nations peoples in Canada.
Coming up, we're going to learn more about how Quebec's hydropower company was historically built dams without regards to the autonomy and rights of Canada's native people. But before we let you go, Jeff, because we wanted to focus in on Canada today, is there one thing that Americans don't understand about Canada that we should?
It's a great question. One thing, I've been teaching Canadian politics for 25 years now, and I think it would just be very valuable for us to pay more attention, I think, and I oftentimes say something that's not probably seen as funny on the Canadian side, that Canada is actually a foreign country. Sometimes it might be worth our recognizing that it's not, it really is a foreign country. They have a right to have their own national interests, but also to understand the long history that's been so benefits. We are so fortunate, let's put it that way, to have Canada on our northern border and to have had the relationship that we've had with them.
Jeff Ayers is professor of political science at St. Michael's College in Vermont. He focuses on international relations and Canadian politics. Joined us today from NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Jeff, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. Coming up, what kind of relationship does Canada have with its Indigenous people today, known as First Nations? We're going to hear more about that from a reporter and host from New Hampshire Public Radio, joining us to explain this within the context of the quest for cheap hydropower in Quebec. More after the break. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. We've been talking about Canada today, and now we're zooming in on Quebec, specifically Hydro-Quebec, the fourth largest hydropower company in the world. It produces the cheapest low-carbon electricity in North America, but how it got here involves a history of encroaching on some of Quebec's Indigenous people. For more about this, from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio, Sam Evans-Brown joins us. He's host of Outside In, a podcast at New Hampshire Public Radio. Sam, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So tell us a little bit briefly about your podcast, Outside In. Again, I mentioned you're from New Hampshire, but this was something you were focusing in on Quebec and the culture there.
Yeah, so this was a project that we launched last year, and I spent most of the year working on it. We traveled up to northern Canada twice for, you know, about 10 days at a time. And just to give folks a sense of how far we drove, you know, there's a lot of Canada up there. and the first trip was about a 20-hour drive north up along the north shore of the St. Lawrence River. And so we were investigating not just the history of Hydro-Québec, but also the connection between the development of hydropower in Quebec and the sort of long-standing push to export the production of those dams down into the New England electrical grid.
The relevance to this story in New England, because Massachusetts is trying to buy hydropower from Quebec?
Yeah, there's currently been a deal inked between Hydro-Québec, a power line developer in Maine. Central Maine Power is going to build the line that will connect Hydro-Québec to New England, and Massachusetts, who bought 9.5 terawatt hours, which is just to say a lot. It's about what a nuclear power plant, a large nuclear power plant, would produce over the course of a year worth of hydroelectricity across that line. And this has been a long time coming. I mean, Massachusetts has a law that was passed in, I think, 2008 called the Global Warming Solutions Act that says that they have to reduce their carbon output economy-wide by 25% by 2020 and then 80% by 2050. And those are legally binding targets. So if they miss them, they will be sued by environmental groups. And so they're very, very serious about getting it done.
Your podcast, Outside In, also focuses in on how Hydropower Quebec came to be a symbol of the French-Canadian people. Explain that for us.
Yeah, it's actually something that was fascinating to find out because, you know, I think the experience that many of us have when we get our electric bills is just sort of, you know, it's a company that is anonymous and we don't know much about it. The only interaction you typically have is when there's a power outage because of a storm. And you know, the logo at the top is just something that you kind of rage against every time you have to pay that bill. But in Quebec, it really is something that has come to symbolize this project of French-Canadian nation building. And it was a very deliberate campaign that began in the 1960s during something called the Quiet Revolution, when French Canadians were again very deliberately taking back the institutions of Quebec that had heretofore been dominated by Anglo and often American business interests. And one of the things that they did in order to achieve this goal was something called the second nationalization. So they had already nationalized a few of the electric companies around Quebec City and Montreal. But in 1962, there was this campaign that was basically a referendum where they asked the people, do you want to buy all of the power companies in the province of Quebec and create a provincially owned company that would employ French Canadians, where French would be spoken on the job sites, where French engineers would be able to get good jobs, and we would build these incredible massive hydropower projects that ultimately would power Quebec, but also would enrich the province by selling power to its neighbors.
But there's a tension there. I understand nearly one third of the dams that power this were built on the ancestral territory, the Pessimit Inuit. Tell us about them.
Yeah, so this is the first mega project that happened immediately after the nationalization of Hydro-Québec. There were already dams underway on the Pessimit Inuit's territory. And this is just to situate yourself, if you follow the Gulf of St. Lawrence north from Montreal, the dams sort of spread up along the St. Lawrence. And so these were, you know, the first mega project was called the Manic-Outard, so it dammed two rivers, the Manicouagan and the Outard rivers. And this was in the 1960s into the 1970s. And when you talk to people from the Pessimit community who were around at that time, what they'll tell you is that they received no notification. They had no idea this project was coming. And there were people who literally told me the first time they heard about these dams was when they rounded the bend in the river on their annual migration to their hunting and trapping territories, where they spend the winter, and they found a worksite in progress on this ancestral highway that they'd used literally for hundreds of years to get to these territories.
Sam, I think we have a clip, I think, from a Pessimist elder that was describing what you've just mentioned. Let's hear that.
Everything has been drowned. They lost all their gears. Their camps were flooded. Their equipment to hunting equipment, trapping equipment was flooded. Their canoes, the nets to fish for the living of their family. Everything was lost without any kind of compensation.
So, Sam, tell us more about who was speaking and what happened. Was there a settlement between Hydro-Québec and the Pessimists?
There was a settlement, and it's largely been seen as somewhat abusive. This happened in 1973, and it was just before as Hydro-Québec was launching its second mega project, the James Bay, which was massive. And at this point, 50% of Hydro-Québec's generating capacity is up at the James Bay. And so as Hydro-Québec was moving on from that first mega project to the second one, they inked this deal that many of the Pessimists saw as being compensation for just a single power line that was crossing their territory. But in reality, what the deal said was, we're going to give you $200,000 for all damages to your territory, past, present, and future. And that worked out to something like just about a little over $100 per person in the community. And what makes this very striking is that just 2 years later, the Cree, who host the James Bay Project, it's another First Nation farther north, they signed a landmark deal called the James Bay and Northern Quebec Agreement after successfully filing an injunction and getting work stopped at the James Bay Project that compensated them with millions of dollars. And later, that deal was renegotiated, and over the course of the decades, the Cree have earned almost $5 billion in exchange for hosting hydropower on their territory, whereas the Pessimist, had this one deal signed in 1973 that was just over $100 per person.
Mm-hmm. Has anything been done to make that situation better for the Pessimists?
They have an ongoing lawsuit that has been working its way through the court since 1998, and it sort of moves in fits and starts whenever the community has enough money to hire lawyers to get things going. And this is what I think is very interesting about this story, is that you can care about climate change and think that we need to decarbonize our electric grid. And think that hooking up to Hydro-Québec is a good way for New England to do that. But what you have to realize is that when we create those power lines, you don't get to choose which electrons we get. You are receiving electrons from these projects that were built on Pessimist territory with no notification and with very minimal compensation. But you might also be getting electrons from the more modern projects, which benefit from the fight that the Cree undertook in the 90s. And now, communities vote before dams are built on their territory as to whether they're going to cut a deal with Hydro-Québec, as to whether they agree that the construction should happen. It's not a problem-free relationship, but it's much less fraught than it used to be.
Sam Evans-Brown, we just have a couple of minutes, and I'm curious, when we think about the buying power here in New England with hydropower and cheaper low-carbon electricity, what role do we have to play in that relationship that Quebec has with its First Nations and how they are treated?
That's a very interesting question, and it's actually very tough to say, but I can tell you what people, the sort of decision makers in Massachusetts, have told me when I asked them that question. And it can be summed up with the phrase, siting is a local matter. Which is to say, if Canada wants to build these dams, it's their choice as to how it gets done. It's not for us to decide whether we believe they're a good idea or not. And certainly that's a convenient stance to take if you would rather not think about these issues north of the border. I can tell you that in the past, in the 1990s, when the Cree were fighting against the damming of another river called the Great Whale, they brought their campaign against that dam down south, and it was pressure from Americans that led to the cancellation of a contract with New York State, which ultimately led to the cancellation of the Great Whale Project. Mm. So, you know, certainly there is economic power that can be wielded sort of through pressure to local representatives.
We'll have to leave it there. But Sam Evans Brown, thank you so much. Host of Outside In. We'll link to our website so our listeners can check it out. Sam, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
He comes from New Hampshire at Public Radio. Thanks for listening to Where We Live. Thanks to Kyone Wolf, Zandra Allen, and producer Carmen Baskoff. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel.